very much, Paul. The first poem I'm going to read is it's on page 12, if you have the book, on Christmas morning. It sets up the entire theme, prophesying the past, I suppose. It's the poet in the 21st century looking back at post-rural electrification Ireland, and the characters in the poem are looking towards their futures. On Christmas morning, my father's father is bounding across his farm. Three small heads follow, having brought the gifts of the Magi to less fortunates, shortcutted by their own fields. The patriarch ignores the bulk of poles the country has erected on his land, though he is grateful for the electric in his home. Santa Claus was able to turn on the kitchen lights and see where everything went last night, coming to the younger ones, a boy trotting here now, and a girl at home with mother making Christmas. Outside this morning, after presents and looking skywards, the children sent a prayer to take him safe to the North Pole. This evening, all will milk cows and break bread into little pieces for birds in the cold. But the family will go to Mass next, where children will whisper of the wonders of the man in the red suit. My father's mother will raise the window sash any moment now, and her husband will see again across the love thrown in them. She will call a greeting, wave, and years away, their children will remember Christmas. And the next one is about the most factual poem in the book. It's in exactly directly a story my grandmother told me. It's called Black and Tan. My grandmother knew the opening scrape of her front gate was not a friend. Told us she remembered staying perfectly still, his hard steps crunching through her. She didn't remember his face, how long he stood in her kitchen, what lies or truths she uttered while my infant aunt gurgled in her cot. She did remember his words, "I had a little girl like this at home, myself." For 63 years, she stepped over the spot on her flag floor where the black and tan had stood. And this one is called Holiday by the Sea, and it's very loosely based on the story of a Dublin family, three generations of a Dublin family on holidays in Kerry. The grandmother dies, they ship her home, but they left all her stuff in the B&B, and the landlady found all the stuff and she had to dispose of it, including personal remnants like the rosary beads. So that was that was where the idea for the poem came, Holiday by the Sea. A black bin liner bursts in the sand dune. After their mother died on a caravan holiday at the Kerry seaside, the family stuffed her stuff and left it there, while the blue print dress bought in pennies for the holiday coloured her remains, and the sun scorched the cotton on the roof rack of the family car going back to the city. This was the only sunshine the family saw the whole 2 weeks. One of the children had run to her daddy, "Nana, Nana, fall down on the beach." She died in her son's arms, the sea breezes ruffling her hairdo, spreading a purple hue across her face. After the funeral in Dublin, after the children returned to school, winter came, rain fell on her grave, and in a high tide, the sea claimed her remnants from the bin liner, brass, knickers, cardigan, slacks, green Wellington boots, boxes, glacier mint seeping through their wrappers, slips, slippers, tight sandals, and the Bible and rosary beads she clasped at Sunday Mass in Castle Weatherby, where the priest welcomed all holiday makers, wishing them a safe journey home. Yeah. And the next one was published by Les Murray, actually, in Quadrant in Australia. And it was loosely based on the story of a woman who the husband died and she didn't keep any of his effects except his Wellington boots. So just that was the beginning of the poem. They made the sound of her man. She kept his Wellington boots under her bed, uncleaned, dusty, since being removed from his body, blood stains fading from the wounds where the bull gouged him. She kept no lock of hair, or his pipes, nothing but the Wellingtons and wedding photo on the mantel. Horns plunged through his groin, stomach and chest, hooves smashed his face before the bull casually strolled off to shag another cow. His own bull he had raised from a calf, his own bull who turned on him one hot August day in an incautious moment when he was dogless in the field. The neighbour who found him found a piece of his penis on the grass, but hid it in his pocket from the wife. After the funeral, the bull slaughtered, the herd sold, she slipped the boots under the bed before undressing and sleeping overhead. The wellies told her he was close. She heard his clapping in them before his face appeared for meals. He pulled them off only before climbing into bed beside her every night, where he made love to her every night and again every morning. He made the sound of a man. He made the sound of a man. Yep. Oh yes, The Bass Fish. I wrote this in Corporate Sherry. Bob Jennings is here this evening. He's the director of the Corporate Sherry Storytelling Carnival, a great festival in September. It's well worth going down. And it was the last day and I'd written nothing. And there was a man fishing on the seashore and I just asked somebody what is he fishing for and they said bass. So the poem came in about 3 minutes. And I've been trying for the Tribune, Hennessy Tribune Awards, for several years at the time. Funny enough, this is the one that got, well, that got published as a Tribune, but it didn't win the Hennessy. It's on page. Fair enough. Yes, page 54. The Bass Fish. Casting out, I hope, for a bass. As this evening a woman's coming and I'm cooking. She lifts something in my heart. She's new to these parts, which is why I want to catch the bass, to thrill some aphrodisiacal mood. I hope maybe it will make her want for me and wish for me, and if she wants a man, there aren't too many in the village, and none of them can fish like I can. I cast afresh, awaiting the bass. Smile to myself at our chats in the pub. So far, she's mighty interesting. Details the life she used to live in a shitty city. I laugh with my final cast, long for a bass. I'll never do what her husband used to, going to the supermarket to fish. On payday, stupid man wonders now why she left, which is just my luck. Just my luck. And a few marriage relationship poems. Dinner. Pained by peeling shriveled mushrooms. He sets his home face light bright. She waits, impatient with chopped onions, to mush with the fungi, drizzle on a non-stick pan, the surface long scratched away. They eat with silence. And facing the stick, page 33, facing the stick, as the husband moves out of the house. Again, it's not me. Facing a skip. In the middle of the move, I try to scrap things I know I would use again. with the consequences of what you hit me with. Tool bits, hinges, old bills, negatives never to be reprinted, broken clocks. Yes, useful things. I was damn handy around the house. I write my new place address for the removal man, telling him I follow by car with the last of my bits and pieces. You left the window open this morning before going golfing. A window I inserted myself, with you holding the frame in place, while I drilled in my marks. My marks are everywhere here, my love. Thank you. And the other side of that, this is called Mrs. H. 41. Your gold band has not expanded, contracted since that day it was placed with love. An Aunt Lynn present has threaded, but you've reworked it, creating cushion covers, dishcloths, daily cleaning for him, washing for him, feeding him, giving yourself to him, took you to a hospital bed. You grasp your ring, try to roll it round, a mannerism you picked up after marriage. And a few World War II poems. My grandmother was born in 1944. It was very, very loosely based on my grandmother. It started with the image of the haircuts where a bowl was placed in their head and the hair was cut around. My grandmother wore 1944. You begin to suffer rations gladly, to suffer for those who are suffering worse, to each their own tea jar, sugar jar. Your boys pull beetroot from the vegetable garden. You don't skin them, just snip tops and bottoms, plunge into boiling water. You can no longer afford the cleaning girl once a week, but keep her on anyway for her mother's sake, and a cousin of hers would be at the front right now. Here is no tableau of peacefulness, knowing people who know people who know people gone. A young man you met at a turn on the floor in a great house party gets killed. Your husband still plays his part, talking senselessness with other men, helping the rations with extra fists of grain to favoured neighbours, blind-eyeing townspeople who rob the head of cabbage or a stick of a carrot from his killed garden. Preparing for back to school, you shear your four sons' blonde heads. Thank God they are so young that in Kerry you are far away from war. You want your man to stop the daily newspaper your sons pore over on the weeds and turns of your kitchen table, making their play glamour battles in fading after school sun. Your girls tell your boys that they digging trenches and shooting stick pistols at each other, but their father claims all this natural in peace or war. You scour the table to shirking sounds of guerrilla warfare and call them in for their tea. Yep. This one's called NIGI 1945. NI as in Northern Ireland, GI as in the American GIs, General Infantry, and the year of 1943. NIGI 1943. When the GIs arrived, De Valera worried for the virtue of Northern girls, angrily asked why United States of America hadn't sought permission. Meanwhile, the men, some of them even black men, copulated in pre-rural electrification bushes. The women had never known such excitement in their dry lives. But the war was nearly over, and soon only a sheen of sweat remained. Fathers, mothers, and De Valera wiped their brows and slapped their own backs again for Mother Ireland's great sense of hospitality. And the next one, I hope it is okay on here. It's actually a visual form. It's on the page copy. It's a visual form as well. It's called, it's about pilots and the girls they left behind. It's called Air Force Sweethearts. They flew into the girls in advance of marriage. No other time, a better excuse than more time. If I am killed, my love, I at least will have had each other. But in the pilot said, my child will live on. She'll be grateful having it. My child will live on. Nothing, the hungry bastard. The girls were left broken hearted too. So. And this one, I was in London last week with Eileen Sheen, and we were reading the Portrait Society. And I didn't read this, even though it's set in London. I was kind of afraid to read it there. And I didn't want to. Didn't know if I might offend somebody or whatever. But anyway, I'm going to read it in Cork. King's Cross, St. Pancras. There's a red Indian on the Victoria line, westbound in full regalia. Commuters appear afraid. Stare, he's so real. Opposite him, another man in a pinstripe suit reads his evening scandal. He nostrils disapproval. I stifle a chuckle, smile wide as the west, imagining him going to work on a horse show, bringing his briefcase in the saddlebag, holding an umbrella aloft, answering his mobile, dismounting and brushing dirt from his clothes. The red Indian takes out a discman, briefly weaves the red hot chili pepper CD cover credits in a HMV bag and pops it in. I'm getting off, seven sisters. Look forward to my Marks and Sparks dinner and a bit of TV. Fisherman's Home, page 63. There's a lot of fishing poems. I've written a lot of fishing poems, and there are about three in this book. All my family were fishing people, even my grandmother fished. I don't like it, but no patience for it at all. It's called The Fisherman's Home. His cap became a kneeler when he blew started the fire. On June nights, when he returned late, he still lit it, warming the walls for the night. Lit it from instinct, comfort from and for his ancestors, knowing they needed it, that it kept evils away. Some nights, they cooked at the fire, toasting bread and a long fork, boiling an egg in a bean can. Then he would read a while, May to October, light fiction, deeper literature in winter. By 2 in the morning, he was sleeping. Thank you very much. The next one's called The Main Award, page 50. The men's ward. In a bed of hygienic white, he stares ahead at the past. Bright nurses feed, shave, pill pop him. He tries to put his mind away when they strip him, the tinkle of potency is disgusting him. People come, children with tales of their living lives. Grapes and day-old newspapers. They wait while he stares back at the future. Thank you. And I'll try this one, Supermarket Fish. It's a father-daughter poem. And I suppose it's more a daughter-father poem, really, and about the daughter who stayed at home to look after the father and never had a life of her own. Supermarket Fish. Her wanderlust shells turn up when her father goes digging for worms, seeing the booty in his hands. She cries inside the window. As a girl, she'd chosen them on the beach one summer. It rains, so she fetches him back to the house, his bean can for worms left on the footpath, letting the squirming things drown. His digging fork, loose in the earth, will have fallen by morning. She dries his head, lets him stay in his oil coat that smells of distant fish, presses a soup bowl into his earthed hands. Then she puts a dinner on the table, fish she bought at the supermarket that he thinks he caught. I'll try this on page 65. It's called A Sunday Alone, and it's kind of one of those quick poems that I thought nothing of. And then Cyphers picked it up, and it was the first time I'd been in Cyphers. And later on, Peace and Freedom in the UK took it up as well. And anyway, A Sunday Alone. The neighbour's pet rabbit nibbles closer to the front wall. Elephant-like sounds of the main road, not today noise polluting him or me. Our greens hope for a shower to wash the week's dust that is inside my lungs. Buses will cringe for space round 8 again tomorrow, but only the odd one passes today. So I can stay in my garden, feet on the grass, and hear the rabbit munch. Yep. And I will try this one in Galway with Fred Johnston last Thursday week. I thought I'd read this one because I was in Galway, and it says in Ballinasloe. So I said, "Well, how far is Ballinasloe from here?" And they kind of said, "Who cares?" So, but I read it anyway. And if you go to Ballinasloe, you can see this shop. At least it was there 3 years ago. Anyway, it was a garage and a car repair shop. And they closed down and just left everything as it was. So it was almost like you take a photograph, jotted down what was in the window, and that became the poem. Led Moriarty was the part of the masquerade. Shop window, Ballinasloe, 2008.
When J.J. Kelso died, his family, closing the shop, took some of his wares and placed them in the window. The shells age, dust and dirt gathers, ivy and other green grows through floor cracks. But tourists stop, and amaze at the window with the Irish Dunlop genuine tube, the Lucas contact set, a fan belt in a box, Restorio, the supercar polish, Franco valves, Ford spark plugs, an advertising board for Leyland, Australia, a pay and decarbonising set, Euron, the finest brake lines in the world. Borg and Beck clutch plate, crankshaft for Austin 7 and Big 7, 1946-39. Fedora brake linings, Sinclair radiator stop leak, ball bearing water pump kit, and a calendar. Esso, wish all our customers a happy Christmas and a prosperous 1951.
And it's there, the calendar from 1951. Okay, I'll just do two more. This one is called Counterparts. It's a Chernobyl one. And my niece inspired it. She was a baby at the time, and she had a little all wrapped up in her Western privileged life with her Chernobyl Children's Fund flag lid sticker, and that's where the poem came from. Counterparts for the newborn of Chernobyl. At 7 months, I'm wearing a white sticker for horror in the other corner. In 7 years, I will, God willing, still wear it when she is in her new world. At 14, I will understand why I wore it. Anger, fear will rise inside me. At 21, I might take up her cause,
I may not care, or maybe somebody in another corner will be holding a flag there for me. And I'll finish with this one. Is that okay, Paul? Yeah, right now. Yeah, we'll try this one, matching the pattern that's been asked for in the book. It's matching the pattern. It's years now since I've done any wallpapering at all the christenings, stations, Christmas time things, American relations visits. My wallpaper stuck on at mine. My brother's vegetable garden, my sister's flower garden got renounced. Sibling teases included me as a wallflower, that it was appropriate, the wallflower wallpapers. It's just me now, here, and though I'm unsteady with heights, I think I'll do the room again one last time before winter falls in and the house will be ready for waking. Thank you very much.